Good morning and welcome to Atlanta Business Radio. I am Amy Otto, joined by Lee Cantor. And Happy New Year, Lee.
Happy New Year, Amy. First show of the year.
How was your holiday?
Awesome.
Yeah.
Went to Florida. It's 85 there. Do you know that?
What
is it here?
It's
not 85.
It was 20 degrees when I went to walk my dogs this morning, and it made me realize I'm really happy I live in Atlanta.
Not Kansas? What is it in Kansas?
Kansas, it's like three degrees, and it will be for the next 2 months. So it was very cold this morning, and I'm happy that it's just short-lived in the South. Love the weather in Atlanta. So what's your New Year's resolution?
Exercise more.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You and everyone else.
Interval training.
I believe in interval training.
That's what I'm going to try.
We need to talk offline about interval training. I think you really can trick your metabolism and your body by interval training.
That's what I'm shooting for.
Firm believer. So if, like, mid-podcast, you need to get up and start doing
some sprints.
We'll understand. We will definitely understand.
Thanks.
Well, again, Lee, there's only a few things that excite me more than Kenny Rogers.
It's the show, isn't it?
It's the show. Mm-hmm. Yes, and actually the guests today. We have two great guests, and actually we have three. We have Melissa at the end, and I am very much looking forward to hearing more about their businesses and what gets them out of bed every morning. I'm sure it's not interval training every day.
Maybe it is.
You never know. They're looking quite fit. Looking quite fit. Well, good morning, Jim Dawson. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show from ADI Performance. We'd love to hear a little bit more about your business. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be here.
And tell us, are you originally from Atlanta?
No, can't tell by my accent. Everybody else says New York City.
New York City. How long have you been in the South?
23 years, actually.
So you're almost a native. I think it's, 18 years, and then you're a native?
In Atlanta, I thought it was like 5 years.
I spent 9 years in Vermont, and they said you couldn't even be born there and be a native. You know, your parents had to be born there to be a native.
I think we're easier here in Atlanta.
Yes.
So what brought you to the South 23 years ago?
Actually, it was a transfer with AT&T to come down and work within a data center.
What did you do for AT&T?
I did a lot of things, actually, in the 17 years I was at AT&T. I had 18 different jobs, so I guess I couldn't hold a position. I kept on trying to get it right. But anything from telecommunication planning to data centers to system design to different support functions within the organization, even did some sales.
So you kind of specialize in human functioning within a workplace, am I correct?
That is correct. In fact, it was my experience with AT&T when I had a chance to go to Bell Labs for 6 months and try to get some very smart people just to talk to each other that I realized there's a lot of intelligence around, but there's not a lot of, you may say, group functioning properly. So I really do focus on the human interaction and performance in a business.
So tell us about your business now.
Well, our business now is what we do is we go into organizations and look at what they're doing and see what they need as enhanced performance. If we look at most organizations, leadership is always an issue, especially individuals stepping up and taking charge and making sure they knew what was going on. But bringing people together is also a very critical factor. And we all talk about it, but not very many people know how to do it. And it's not difficult, but you have to keep focused on what your mission and goals are.
What is a typical problem that the big corporations don't seem to get?
Well, we have one course which is called a winning business case in performance-based leadership. And what they don't get is the people that are in the business have a lot of the answers that they need to solve major problems. We worked with Lucent Technologies a couple years back. And what we actually found out is that by training the managers, midline, first-line managers, on how to talk to upper management and how to develop a business case, we recovered over $12 million for them.
Is it a trust issue that the upper management just doesn't trust the middle management?
I think some of it's a trust issue, but more than anything else, it's a communication issue. How do I actually present my information to upper management? How do I develop the network that I need and the support I need and the people to support my idea to move forward? Most people come up with an idea and they don't feel like they're heard, so all of a sudden they start complaining. And what we try to do is turn those complaints actually into commitment and action to get things done for organizations, because if somebody's complaining, it says they care about something.
And then is it a system you put in place, or is it just the teaching them the tools, the communications tools that...
Well, it's teaching the tools, and it's also the commitment from upper management to be present to hear the business cases, which we also facilitate. So mm-hmm. when people come in, since they're not used to being in this format, that they're actually able to present their ideas much more effectively, and that's what it's all about, is presenting your
right.
ideas. Be able to take the pushback that's going to come,
right?
Because no plan is perfect, so there's
right.
going to be some pushback. And then how to move forward to get the commitment from management to move forward, and actually how to change those people's minds.
Meaning the employees?
Well, actually, upper management.
Okay.
Once you have the employees in a setting and they see that they have an opportunity to make a change, they get very excited about that.
So having satisfied employees increases customer satisfaction. How do you go about that? I mean, are there gauges you put on self-expectation?
Well, it depends on the business and what benchmark we're looking at. For example, when you talk about customer satisfaction, how many customer complaints are you having now, and why are you having them? So if we start looking at that, we develop targeted material that we will actually reduce complaints and increase interaction. It's the way people communicate with each other and how they see what the end product is. If it's not my job, you have a difficulty with any employee. And I like the pronoun test. When you talk to employees, are they saying we and us or them?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's, once you get that down, then you can work from there and work with it. And we also have to teach management how to talk to employees.
Is there a way that you quantify whether progress is being made?
What we look at is, what are they measuring now? And mm-hmm. we want to improve those indexes on that measurement.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we had one client that was getting a complaint a day, a major complaint a day. And after our classes, they had a complaint a month. I think that's a pretty good index.
Right.
So this customer service strategy, do you have this in print form? Do you have any books you'd like to talk about?
Actually, we do have a book called Customer Service in the Real World. And that has a number of different articles on customer service from a number of other people that we brought together. And we basically did a chapter on from a call center perspective.
So where did you do your research for the book?
My research from the book is because I also have a call center that I manage, that I own. So I do it live with the people that I have. Mm-hmm. Our whole objective is to bring people into a position to get other people in front of decision makers. So we're training people on how to get in front of CFOs, CEOs, plant mm-hmm. managers on a regular basis and set up the stage so someone else can go in and sell them a service or a product.
So do you do training within companies? Once
yep.
somebody hires you,
or is
how
it
long
a turnkey,
is the process?
Is that a turnkey solution where someone could just hire your company to make the calls to set up the appointments?
Both ways. We will train the business, and it depends on what people are doing. If you look at a lot of businesses, what you're looking for is what type of sale do they have. If it's a complex sale, there's a certain dollar figure that you got to break it off, whether they should do it out of their own business or give us to do it
right.
or bring it inside. So what we really look at is what are their needs are, and if we can't provide that service for them, we can train them how to do it.
Right.
And what got you interested in all this?
Well, that's it's interesting. I went in 1993, I actually took a class, which was a Stephen Covey class. And it said Leadership for the Future, and I started planning my own goals and see where my strengths and my talents were. And I was very heavily involved in high tech. And all this tech I'm doing is saying, I should train. Now, you have to understand, I'm learning disabled. The last thing I was going to do was be a teacher, in essence. But after I took that, there was no looking back. And in 1996, I've been out on my own, and we've never looked back. So the whole idea of getting interest, I started retreats in the mountains, in North Georgia mountains in 1984, communication retreats. And all of a sudden I was attracting people from as far away as Alaska to come to the retreats.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I have a talent to observe and look and then make people better. And we never do anything that's negative or degrading to anyone. It's all on a positive basis on how do you get better improvement.
It's interesting with technology and things going online with the internet and text messaging and emailing. Right. I think so often we lose the art of true communication. It sounds like you focus on that in these group meetings.
That's very true. And again, with all of technology and online services and tech is good, and it helps us in a productive way. What you have to look at, though, is how many people do you know that can actually hold a conversation?
Absolutely.
See? So yeah. What we're looking at is how do you communicate with other people? In fact, we have an anger management class that people come to. And what it is a lot of people have a forced timeout because the county is telling them you have to go to this class after they see a judge.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could do things before we had a forced timeout? So it's all of these different things on just how to communicate what we want and how we want. And I'll bring this up. I just celebrated my 40th anniversary. That's not an accident. Hmm. That's because we wanted to be together for 40 years, and we worked through all those different communication links.
Wow. Congratulations. Well, that is a big milestone.
It is.
So the services you offer, they transcend business into personal?
Everything we do in class you can put in your personal life, and that's what a lot of people like about our interaction. Mm-hmm. It's just not business focused. If you're a different person in business than you are outside, there's a disconnect.
Right.
Now, there's different environments. I use the example if I send someone to the Arctic because they're great at doing what they're doing, how are they going to dress? Well, they're going to dress with a heavy coat like we got today here in Atlanta. 6 months later you're in the Amazon, you're going to take the same suitcase.
Right.
I doubt it.
Not.
But they're the same people. So when we're dealing inside a business or outside a business, how is that connection that we can be the same person? We don't have to be two different people.
Right.
And that's the neat thing about it.
Wow. I'm sure there's a lot of listeners that would love to hear more about ADI Performance and about your book. What is the best way for someone to reach you or contact you?
Well, they can either reach us by email, and that is jrdawson@adiperformance.com.
Do you have a website?
Yes, we do, and that is www.adiperformance.com. So they can visit that. They can see all our course material, our published articles, and what we do and how we do it.
And what size companies could acquire your services?
Actually, we have worked from the Fortune 100 companies all the way down to mom and pop, depending on what the needs of the services are. So we've actually worked individually with people. So anything in between, and it's just what the need is.
Right. So the best way is to have a conversation with you, right?
That's correct.
Excellent. Yes. Excellent. I encourage everyone to get in touch with Jim. A lot to learn. And thank you for being a part of our show this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Cork, highly successful executive and entrepreneur. I've heard Brian Cork speak at a Catalyst event where he was honored. He's one of the top 25 entrepreneurs. Very extensive background all over the board, professional athlete, executive recruiter, and business coach. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, Brian.
Thanks, Amy. I'm glad to be here.
So you've raised over $500 million in private placement capital. Tell us about that.
Oh, that was yesterday. When I managed to get out of college, I found myself, like a lot of people, trying to figure out, where my greatest talents were. And interestingly enough, my own career path has always, felt happenstance for many, many years. I had found myself as a professional triathlete and then became, had some really good success. I was the amateur champion in 1988 for the Malibu Triathlon, was making money, well-sponsored, and then unexpectedly was injured. And I had to rehab myself by living out of my car, and was befriended by a securities attorney in Los Angeles who took it upon himself to introduce me to some very successful people in the L.A. Basin. And they were convinced that I needed to become a stockbroker. And before I knew it, I was what they were calling back then an L.A. gunslinger, and was the go-to guy for raising first rounds of capital for some companies that you buy products for today. And I would say between 1989 and 1995, I raised just about $500 million in private placement capital.
So how did being a triathlete help you in that arena?
Discipline, maybe. the triathlon, that multidiscipline environment, I think taught me a lot about myself in terms of my ability to persevere, mm-hmm. my ability to focus, my ability to recognize opportunity.
And did you have mentors? You said somebody kind of took you under their wing to kind of encourage you to do this, but did they help you make those initial connections? Because I'm sure it's a different world in the triathlon community.
You know, a thread of continuity in my entire life has always been me being stubborn and somebody smarter than me stepping in, watching me break myself in half, and then maybe learning a lesson and coming back around. And the first best mentor I think I ever had was my own granddad.
Mm-hmm.
And he once introduced me to his best friend in Nebraska, saying, "Hey, this is my grandson, Brian. You could drop him buck naked into Nebraska cornfield, and in 2 weeks he'll own the farm." I had no idea what that meant until I was about 30 uh-huh. years of age. And granddad also said great things like, "If you're going to judge a man, do it by the people he surrounds himself
mm-hmm.
with."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And years later, when I was in college, a little bit of background. I was a high school All-America track and field cross country. Dad was a military officer. We found ourselves moving literally every 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of those kids that got passed through school without ever taking, you know, tests or doing term papers. And I was borderline illiterate, but I could run like the wind. And interestingly enough, my mom sorted out that if I was ever going to go to the Olympics, I would need coaching. So she convinced me to take my SATs, and I knocked out a 1420.
Wow.
She had done some background work for me and was talking to coaches, and three coaches were willing to give me a chance in college. So I went on a scholarship to Radford University. Within the first 2 weeks, I was busted by one of my professors in a poli sci class, a guy named Nick Pappas, who was a highly decorated war veteran from Vietnam. And he comes stomping into the classroom one day, clutching in this big, huge ham of a fist, a paper that I had written, okay? And he goes, "Cork, where's Brian Cork? You're an abomination. You don't belong in university. What are you going to do about this?" I'm like, "Well, what do you want me to do?" He looks at me. He's towering over me, and I'm mortified. And he says, "Come into my office every day before practice or after practice. As a matter of fact, before and after practice."
Wow.
"And I'm going to teach you how to write." And he did. Now, interestingly enough, and there's some more continuity here. Later that year, my granddad visits me at school, and he brings me a book. It's called Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
Mm.
Okay,
and that's a formative book.
Much so. And then within 3 days of that, Nick Pappas also puts that book in my hands.
Wow!
Oh, wow!
And I was intrigued by that book.
Yeah. And that's not a quick read.
No. It took me months to read the book,
mm-hmm.
but I relished every single page. And when Nick Pappas put that book in my hands, he says, "This is a dissertation on uncommon characteristics of smart people."
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, out of school, I did a couple of things. But, you know, during school, I was, another story. I was such a prima donna runner. I was, freshman All-America at college. You know, I'd had some success. But after the season was over, my coach walks up to me and says, "Hey, Cork, you're off the team. You're a pain in the butt, and you're hard to coach, and I can't build a program around you, so you're off the team." And that was one of those breaking moments.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
How far into the book were you at that point?
Two-thirds, I suppose. But I'd then begun to sell moonshine out of West Virginia.
I was going to ask you, what was the most bizarre thing you've ever done for money, but I think you just answered that.
Maybe.
Thank you. if I'm blushing, we'll talk about this off record. That was one of the best teaching elements I think I've had in terms of how to put money together for businesses. But Nick Pappas was interested. You know, maybe he's more concerned about what I was doing at the time, but I needed to raise money for school, right?
Mm-hmm.
So. I recognized the need for a commodity, and I found a way to deliver it.
Right. Entrepreneur.
Entrepreneur. Tried and true. And, coming out of school, are actually, instead of selling moonshine, I decided to start working for a moving company. And it was called Cook's Transfer at the time. And I took what I learned from Ayn Rand's book, and when I graduated from school, I bought that company from a fellow that my boss was actually dying of cancer. And he would have no pension, and neither would his wife. And so I walked up to him as I graduated. I said, hey, you let me buy this business from you, and I'll make sure that you know you and your wife are taken care of for the rest of her days. And I scraped together some money, bought the business, and in about 18 months, I sold it for 5 times our investment.
Wow.
And she's been fine ever since.
Wow, that's now, a great story.
That's kind of transitioning. You have a philosophy regarding businesses, right? That there's 18 months time in order for them to kind of prove themselves?
You know, Charles Darwin and a couple other guys have these ideas around the laws of natural selection. And, you know, statistically, you know, it's. I think you can look at the life cycle of organizations, and I don't care if it's a secular business or if it's a ministry, but when you start a business, statistically, it takes about 18 months to prove the model. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, you know, if you're not making money, if you're not getting traction within 18 months, you're probably going to fail. That's just statistically. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think, you know, 92% of all startup businesses fail within the first 18 months.
Now, so making money should be that's what you should be focusing on, not like the product per se, but just generating cash?
Well, you know, generating revenue is a good, you know, milestone for, you know, why you're in business, right?
Right.
So,
because there's businesses that don't make money for years, and so you're saying that just by and large is a general rule that you better be generating revenue.
Well, that begs the question, why are you in business?
Right.
You know, there are many companies out there that are trying to develop products. You know, in my view, there's a formula for success. It's product, timing, management, cash, and a plan. Mm-hmm. And so if you've got a good product and it's backed up with good management and capital and the timing is good and, you know, you have a good plan, you're probably going to be successful.
Right.
But if you're not making money in 18 months, the life cycle of product development, you know, it's overextending itself.
Right.
And that's probably an indication that the people don't want to buy your products.
Right. Okay. And then it's better to just move on.
From the view of a venture capitalist and a trained investment banker, yes.
Right.
You know, because as I transitioned from being a stockbroker and so this is sort of an awkward segue, but another great mentor I had was David Sugarman, who was arguably one of the best entrepreneurs I'd ever met in Los Angeles. And I raised a lot of money for his early projects, and he's the one that taught me how to recognize good leadership and good products.
What was his product?
I think Dave Sugarman's product was his intelligence, his ability to recognize skills and talents in other people. His partner, Saul, was one of the co-inventors of the plain paper fax.
Hmm.
Okay. Wow. And David founded Triple Check, and so you know he just found a way to put together really good deals.
Hmm.
So he was a deal maker.
And you're kind of a connector, right? Is that what Human Capital?
Well, Brian Cork, Human Capital, right, is executive search and recruiting. It's also business coaching and executive coaching. It's, you know, if you look at our logo, Brian Cork is small caps and the Human Capital is large caps.
Right.
So it's not about me, it's about the result.
Right.
That sounds like a tagline, but it's really not. I was a venture capitalist and investment banker.
Right, you've seen every side of this.
Yes. And so there came a day when I decided I wasn't going to be raising money as a focus anymore because my clients, in my view, were needing leadership
not
to protect
their
investors.
Right. Right.
Well, you know, look what happened in the dot-com era. There was a lot of money being raised and wasted. Being raised and wasted by people making bad decisions.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
There were people sitting in the wrong seats.
Right.
It became a personal mission of mine to make sure that people were finding the right career path. And, you know, if you show me a man who's doing the job that he's meant to do and he'll make the better decisions and all the other pieces of that formula begin to snap into place.
Right.
So I, you know, there was literally a day when I realized that I was going to go out there and raise human capital,
right,
less so much than financial capital.
Right. And when was it? That was fairly recently, right?
That was 1997.
Oh, so it's been 10, 11 years now.
Right. And I was brought out to Atlanta, Georgia as a CFO for a company that I took public.
Mm-hmm.
I got a phone call. Let me start over again. Interestingly enough, having raised all that money, you know, I got to meet a lot of very interesting people.
Sure.
And before I knew it, one day, we're living in Louisville, Colorado at the time, we had begun to get phone calls from people that I'd raised money and built their management team saying, hey, we need your help, you know, to find CFOs and other,
right,
you know, other human capital. And all my business at that point was referral. It was an affirmation of the relationship building capability. I get a call from a fellow out here in Atlanta saying, I need a CFO that can do five things. And I said, I don't know anybody that can do those things.
Right.
And he goes, well, I know one guy. That would be you. I was like, oh, well, okay, yeah, I could do that.
Wow.
And so they brought us out to Alpharetta. You know, this was in 1998. And that my job was supposed to have been to get the ball rolling and then backfill myself. But we got the company. I raised the money. I built the management team. I dropped in an MRP system. I got the company public, and I got it bought.
Wow. That's a success story in and of itself.
Not realizing at the time that if you're not from Atlanta, it's hard to do business here.
It is.
Right.
It's very different. Very different.
And so here I was in Alpharetta with my wife, Joanne, and our first daughter, Haley Ann. And heads down, getting the job done. And before I knew it, I was on everybody's dance card because, first of all, raising capital in this town,
right, it's not easy to do.
And then having a successful IPO and then the investors, you know, making money and having it generally be a success story, it was great.
So it snowballed.
You were Mr. Popularity at that point, right?
I was on a lot of dance cards, and we started doing CFO searches for everybody.
Wow.
And that was heading into the peak of the dot-com era. And I think where we really differentiated ourselves was pump-faking some people and saying, wait a minute, you shouldn't do that job, or you shouldn't be hiring those kinds of people. And you know, physically trying to be the change agent in the Atlanta market.
Right.
You know, using the skills that I developed as an investment banker and the instincts as a venture capitalist, recognizing which companies were not going to make it.
Right.
And in some cases, just looking at a fellow and thinking to myself, he shouldn't take that job because in 6 months,
right,
he's going to be on the street.
Right.
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 You know, I remember I used to run every day through a neighborhood called Crooked Creek. And in 1999, 2000, every third house was in foreclosure.
Wow.
Wow.
But I'm telling you, as I took those runs, I could look at those houses and I would actually say to myself, men that I know are not in those houses.
Right.
Right.
People with the wrong fit in their job. Right. Wow. We could sit and talk for hours,
yeah,
Lee, but I'm looking at the time. How can people reach you? I know the Unsinkable Brian Cork blog is awesome.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit more about that, how people can reach you. I'd love for you to just touch on your book that's coming out, books, plural.
Sure. My personal blog is The Unsinkable Brian Cork, and that's where I get to just vent. I talk about everything that kind of, you know, comes across my mind. And that the coordinates for that are unsinkablebriancork.com. And we're getting about 2,000 hits a day.
Wow.
So there's a little bit of affirmation there. We have a business blog, the Human Capital blog, which is hcroi.wordpress.com. And I am writing three books, and one is entitled The CEO Handbook. The second is This Would Be Thomas Jefferson's View.
Very cool.
And the third book is Dear God, I'm Dancing in My Head. And we expect them all to be finished about mid-year. And hopefully, you know, we'll grab some attention, you know, with
yeah,
with
sounds like you're going to be busy this year.
I hope so.
A wonderful 2008 for you. You might need some help sorting through your mail.
Good segue.
Melissa Cooper, welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. Tell us about Mail Sort, Inc.
Yes, we're a privately held company up in the Duluth-Lawrenceville area, and we've been around since about 1981, and the company has changed and different ways. As customers had different needs, we, you know, changed different opportunities for them. And so right now we currently do mailing, fulfillment, and promotional marketing services. And so that would include, you know, direct mail, any kind of transactional mail, which would be billings and invoices, the really important mail that we all have to make sure to get and pay. And then promotional products. We acquired a company about 5 years ago that does promotional products, which would be all kinds of logo items, T-shirts, hats, pins, you know, all that good stuff you give away to market your company.
What are some of the hot giveaways these days?
Well, in 2007, the digital photo frame was the big, you know, holiday gift.
That'd be cool.
And so I'm actually leaving on Friday to go to our big convention for the weekend, which would be, it's the ASI convention in Orlando, Florida. So we'll be checking out all the new hot items and coming back with a lot of good, fresh ideas for the new year.
So you have a place that's 40,000 square feet in Duluth.
Yeah, well, we actually moved, so it's about 65,000 now.
Wow.
And so we, we're right off of Breckenridge, right near Discover Mills Mall. So we have quite a bit of space, a lot of activity.
So what's in that space?
We have all kinds of mailing equipment, inserters, folders, and then we have a large fulfillment area where we do pick, pack, and fulfillment. We manage some online stores for our customers with their logo products. And
so you handle all the fulfillment? Like
exactly.
A whole turnkey
Very much so, yeah.
And how can people reach you?
Well, our website is currently in the midst of being updated, so all the information on there may not be correct, but it is mailsortinc.com, and they could also reach me at 770-717-5500, and I'm at extension 2250.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for being part of the Atlanta Business Radio Show. Lee, any final comments?
I'm overwhelmed. A lot of good stuff today.
I'm feeling like I need to work out, maybe a little interval training.
Hey, let's go.
All right. Well, wonderful. Have a great day, and until next week, I'm Amy Otto with the Atlanta Business Radio Show.